Good evening. My name is Dave Cresswell, and I've lived in Madison for 25 years. I go to the First Unitarian Society, and it is with great pleasure that I introduce the speaker for this evening. Michael Dowd is a very special speaker, emerging from a background as an evangelical preacher. He has been traveling all around the country for the last 6 years with his wife, demonstrating how science and religion, rather than maybe being somewhat uneasy bedfellows, can actually work very much in synergy with each other and create tremendous power in terms of giving meaning to our individual lives and tremendous power for the sake of our planet. I don't think there is anyone in the world that can bring to this topic of the synergy of science and religion the knowledge, the depth, and the passion that Michael Dowd brings to it. So, with great pleasure, Michael, it's yours.
I'm curious, how many of you have never heard, let me put it this way, how many of you have heard me speak or my wife Connie Barlow speak before? Okay, great, just a few. Okay. Well, my wife and I have lived on the road now for 6 years, and we don't have a home, we don't even have a storage bed. We live permanently out of the generosity of people who open up their homes to us. And what we do is we teach and preach a sacred, meaningful experience of the whole history of the universe. In fact, what we call the great story, what we mean is the story of everyone and everything. It's the universe story told in a sacred, meaningful way. That is the history of cosmos, earth, life, and humanity as one sacred story. One meaningful myth, in the way that Joseph Campbell used the term, not as an untrue story, but a narrative that puts us in accord with the universe, that which helps us feel our connection to the whole of reality. And Connie and I believe that evolution, understood through sacred eyes, meaningful eyes, evolution will usher all the world's religious traditions into their greatness in the 21st century. That is, no religion could possibly emerge into its full potential until deep time was understood. For the simple reason that all religions came into being when people thought the world was flat and stationary and everything revolved around us. I mean, think about it. Shintoism, Buddhism, Taoism, Islam, Confucianism, Christianity, Judaism. All these great faiths emerged when people thought the world was flat and stationary and everything revolved around us. In fact, people didn't so much believe the sun and the stars revolved around us. They thought they knew it. It was like, go out and look. It clearly looks that way. And yet science has now given us the kind of worldview that we see through the Hubble Space Telescope and so many of our other instruments. Science has given us actually a way of seeing who we are, where we are in time and place, where we're going, and what our purpose is, what our role is in this creative divine process. And we finally now have a way of understanding this in a way that validates earlier religious understandings. See, evolution theology, and that's what I'll be sharing this evening, is what's often called evolution theology or evolutionary theology. It's a radically fresh third way beyond the polarized debate that is in the minds of many Americans, which is, on the one hand, you've got your new atheists, Christopher Hitchens, Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, Daniel Dennett, those who are hitting religion hard and heavy from an atheist science perspective. And then, on the far opposite end, you've got your younger creationists and intelligent design folks, and the two are not the same, but they're usually lumped down together. And in the minds of many Americans, that's what's considered the options. That's the only two meals on the menu. And what evolution theology, what I'll be sharing with you this evening, what this perspective offers, is a fresh way of seeing that's as grounded in our best scientific understandings. In fact, Richard Dawkins let me reprint a letter that he wrote to his 10-year-old daughter in my book, Thank God for Evolution. My publisher said, you're never going to get Dawkins to let you print that letter in a book called Thank God Revolution. Well, within 24 hours of sending in the email, he said, sure, he and my wife have known each other for years. And yet, it's also, this perspective is as spiritually nourishing, as religiously satisfying and inspiring as anything that any of these folks are offering. And so, what I'd like to do, since we're a fairly small audience, I'd rather than me give you kind of the 2 hours that I think you might be interested in, because to be honest with you, Connie and I have about 14 hours of really cool, interesting stuff, without even overlapping, right? So rather than me give you the, you know, hour and 45 minutes at, or 2 hours that I think you might be interested in, I'd rather be responsive to what your interests genuinely are. So what I'd like to do is give you just a little more background, and then I will open it up and I want to hear what the questions are, the burning questions, the important questions, the questions that you'd love to hear addressed before we leave tonight. And I'll allow that, I'm not going to answer each question, I just want to hear what the questions are. And that will allow me to have a sense of where to go this evening, because I'm not even going to use the PowerPoint for at least another 40, 45 minutes. So I want this first time especially to be much more dialogical. So let me give you a little more background in terms of why Connie and I do what we do and where we're coming from, and then I'd like to hear your questions. I used to be an anti-evolutionary fundamentalist. You can probably already tell from my style, right? I actively opposed people who taught evolution. I had a small stack of tracts, and I would argue that anybody who thought the world was more than 6,000 years old. And I went to Evangel College. It's affiliated with the Assemblies of God in Springfield, Missouri. And I was unprepared for the fact that at this evangelical college, they would be teaching evolution. In fact, the first day I walked into biology class, the teacher held the textbook, and I had used that same textbook 4 years earlier at the University of Miami, Florida. So I knew that that textbook taught evolution. I freaked. I picked up my books, walked out of class, slammed the door, and went to the registrar's office and approved the course. In fact, I told my roommate, Satan obviously has a foothold in the school. It's the only way I can make sense of how they get me teaching evolution at an evangelical college. Two things shifted. One is that I met the biblical studies and philosophy professors there. I had prayed and worshiped with them. I had studied, you know, I mean, one of them I'd shared life stories with. And then I discovered that they embraced evolution. So I couldn't write them off as being demonically possessed. The other thing is I met a Buddhist Christian. I met somebody who was the most Christ-like, the most thoughtful, compassionate, generous person I'd ever met. He had been a monk for 7 years, and he called himself a Buddhist Christian, but my theology didn't allow even that to be a possibility. It's like, what's a Buddhist Christian? And yet he was the most amazing human being I had met. So my head said, because he was really into evolutionary theology, my head said, get him saved. But my heart said, ask him to mentor you. And my world expanded as a result of this. I ended up then pastoring 3 churches over the course of a decade, 3 United Church of Christ congregations over the course of about 9.5 years. And then I was invited to do environmental sustainability work. I was the head of, basically, my job was to organize Jewish rabbis, Catholic priests, Protestant clergy, and evangelical clergy on key environmental issues that were coming up for vote in Congress. So I did this for a year, and then for 5 years I headed up the first government-funded sustainable lifestyle campaign in the United States, where basically my job was to help neighbors come together and support each other, 5 to 8 households at a time, support each other in using less water, driving less, composting, recycling, all the different aspects of living more earth-friendly, sustainable lifestyle, and building trust and a greater sense of community with their neighbors in the process. In fact, many of these neighbors had never met each other before. So this has been the science and religion and sustainability have been my passion. My wife, Connie Barlow, is a science writer. She's written 5 science books. Her books are published by MIT Press, Copernicus Books, Basic Books. So she's internationally known as a science writer. And we fell in love as mission partners. I met her only 7 years ago. Within hours of meeting her, I knew I had met my mission partner. And within 5 months, I asked her to marry me, and 3 weeks later, we got married. And we've been living on the road for 95% of our married life. So that's my story in a nutshell. So with that as background, I'd love to hear what the questions are that you'd love to hear addressed this evening, related to science and religion, related to evolution and theology, evolution and spirituality, or related to sustainability. Yeah. Is there evil? Yeah, what's an evolutionary theology perspective say on evil? Absolutely. Yeah?
You're not going to give us answers to
Oh, I'm going to answer probably all of them. No, I'm just not going to answer them one at a time, because this way, this will give me a sense of where to go this evening. Yeah.
Eastern philosophy says that
speak up, please.
Eastern philosophy states that whatever appears has to disappear. In other words, including the universe itself. So that means even reason tells us it has to come from nothing and return back to nothing. Everything, including us.
Right.
So, yeah, but nothing is a mystery.
Right.
All of science, as I understand it, and I'm not a learned man, the science is predicated on the concept of the Big Bang. That's when it all started. And then science is a measurement of everything that happened since then. What was it that formed together to produce the Big Bang?
Yeah, I can answer that one real quickly. I have no idea. I mean, I'm not even going to try. See, what I'll be sharing are just what we know about the 14 billion year universe that we live in. I'm not going to be touching on what came before the Big Bang or what's going to happen after the universe of Jesus, heat, death, or any of those kinds of things, because frankly, they're just outside my realm of expertise and focus. Some of them are fascinating questions, such as some of the stuff in terms of string theory and multiple universes. I'm not going to get into any of that. Yeah.
Interested in your sort of intellectual journey from the sort of continuing playing the literal Genesis thing and now from the White House, and how you made that transition.
Great. Okay. And I'll also share how I relate to those who still reject an evolutionary worldview.
Who is God to you?
Who is God to me? Yeah, I'll talk definitely about that.
I'd like to hear how your paradigm fits all.
How does this make sense of, or fit, how does this evolution theology perspective make sense of the differing religious traditions and how they fit together? Yes?
Well, I've always felt that a deductive system cannot have any free agent in it, because you don't know what the free agent will do, and you can no longer deduce. So I've never felt God can be a hypothesis in any scientific deductive system.
Yeah, interesting. More of a statement than a question, but I think I'd agree with
you. Well, I'm wondering, do you agree?
Basically, but it'll be clear what I'm meaning by God, what I'm meaning by science, how I see science and religion spurring each other to greatness, or in a mutually enriching process. And you'll decide whether that makes sense for you or not. One of the things I'll tell you straight up, I'm not interested in converting anybody to the evolutionary worldview. If some of you are young earth creationists, I'm not going to engage with you in debate, because I'm frankly not interested in having you believe like me or think like that. What I am interested in doing is sharing why I am passionately excited about a sacred, meaningful, to use Christian language, a God-glorifying, Christ-edifying, Scripture-honoring way of thinking about evolution. Many young earth creationists have never been exposed to a way of thinking about the science-based evolutionary story of the universe from this kind of a perspective, and that's what I'll be sharing. I'll be sharing it because I'm fired up and excited about it, and it's a perspective that's helping us to cooperate across a wide spectrum of differences in service of a just, healthy, beautiful, and sustainably led human future. And I'll just lay my cards right out on the table. The bottom line for why Connie and I do what we do, why for 6 years we've traveled North America nonstop, and why we'll probably do that the rest of our lives, is that we're committed to doing everything that we can in our lifetime to help ensure a thriving future for planet Earth and as many other species as possible, and doing so to the glory of God. That is, doing so with deep religious devotion. Because we think that in the next 100 years, if we don't find a way of having humans live in a mutually enhancing relationship with the natural world, so that we can ensure a just, healthy, beautiful, and sustainably life-giving future for planet Earth and as many other species as possible. If we don't do that in the next 100 years or so, there may not be any work to be done in another 100, 150 years. So we think that's the great work of our time. I mean, you'd say every age has its great work to do. It's kind of a collective calling of that time and place. This is what we feel is the great work of our time, and it's certainly the work that we feel called to do. Yes?
Isn't this going to have to be done in less than 100 years?
I hope so. Yeah. In fact, I'll share with you why I think it's going to happen in the next 30 to 50 years. Yes.
Yes. I've been getting a program for kids and youth education director at my church around this. So as you
Yeah, she said she's putting together a youth program for kids and wants to know, you know, what's been done. I'm adding a little bit. But what's been done from this perspective in terms of children's education from youngest through teenagers? Yeah, there's actually quite a bit. So if I don't adequately answer that with the whole group talking afterwards. Yeah. Yes? Yeah, how do you relate what we understand about evolution to religion? Natural selection, for example. Well, natural selection is a subset of evolution. Notice that natural selection is...
Natural selection is a theory to explain the fact.
Exactly. Yeah. It doesn't apply... Well, it may not. I need to be humble about this. It doesn't seem to apply in the same way in the non-biological world that it does in the biological world. For example, when you talk about the evolution of galaxies, when the evolution of solar systems, we're not talking quite the same, but yes, you're right. Natural selection is one of the mechanisms, one of the processes by which we understand the fact of evolution. And I'll talk a little bit about that, yes. Yeah, what does this perspective offer in terms of a way of thinking about the major challenges that we're dealing with today, such as overpopulation, species extinction, global warming, peak oil, the growing gap between the rich and the poor, some of these big questions? How does this perspective either inspire us in the face of that or overwhelm us? Well, obviously, it should be clear what I think. In fact, the main program that I delivered for almost 3 years is called Beyond Sustainability. An inspiring vision of the next 250 years, where I take a look at the whole history of the universe compressed into 100 years. Like if you make 14 billion years equals 100 years, every minute on the cosmic century timeline is 250 years. So think about it. If we've got 100 years of trends and patterns and tendencies to look at, to study, to observe, to learn from, do you think there's a few things that we might be able to say with some degree of certainty about what the next minute might be? If we're not, we're in deep trouble. And this is a perspective, this perspective that I'm sharing with you tonight, for many of us, gives us a way of thinking about the big challenges that we and our children and our grandchildren are going to deal with, but not from a place of overwhelm or fear, but from a place of hope and possibility. Realistic hope, not otherworldly hope, like Jesus, the cosmic janitor, is going to come and clean up the mess with you, but a realistic, this world hope. Yeah.
Where does more of
Yeah. The whole notion of war and warfare. I'm probably not going to do a lot with that, but I will say I'll whistle some things in terms of. In fact, I'll say the best book I've ever read in my life on the topic is Robert Wright's book, Non-Zero, and he takes a look at the history of warfare and how warfare, as tragic, as chaotic, as destructive, sometimes as evil as it can be, has consistently catalyzed greater cooperation at larger and wider scale throughout human history. It's an amazing paradox. Now, he's not for war. He thinks that we have to find ways of dealing with natural conflict in non-violent ways because we've got weapons of mass destruction that are smaller and smaller, smarter and smarter, more and more powerful, and more easy to obtain. So our world can be annihilated if we don't have ways of moving. But yes, when we look through the whole history of life, warfare has consistently played a paradoxical role of forcing humans to cooperate at larger and wider scale. You know, let me go ahead and jump in, because I'm not going to hold all this in my head much longer, if at all. There's a few concepts that I think will tie together some of these things. And in another 40, 45 minutes, if I haven't addressed your concern, or please feel free to raise it again. But I wanted to share a couple of core concepts that I think may shed some light on some of these topics. The first is the distinction between private and public revelation. Private revelation and public revelation. Private revelation is an insight that comes through one individual, you know, through a dream or an intuition or, you know, revelation of some sort. And then that intuition or that insight needs to be communicated to others. And others then may or may not believe it. Now, Moses goes to the top of the mountain. Well, something happens, and he tells other people about it. Or the Apostle Paul is on the road to Damascus, blinding, flash of light, revelation. He tells other people about it. Or you have a deep, profound religious insight, and you tell someone about it. Private revelation, by its very nature, produces religious believers or unbelievers. In fact, it can only produce religious believers and unbelievers. Public revelation is what's being revealed about the nature of reality. What's so? What's fundamentally the case? What's divinely true, if you want to use religious language, about the nature of reality? The knowledge of which is not merely coming through the psyche of one individual. I mean, it's sometimes introduced that way. Einstein has a vision of writing a beam of light. But then the whole scientific community goes to work trying to disprove it because he writes a paper about it, and the scientific community as a whole goes to work, especially the physicists, goes to work trying to disprove it. In other words, the skeptical scientific method is all about discerning. Is this true in a measurable, empirical way? That is this true in a way that people of all different religious traditions and people of no religious tradition can agree it's true? Or is it true because it's said to be true because some authoritative or charismatic person said it was true, or because it's been passed down for so many generations that it must be true? And public revelation, which is really what the scientific enterprise, the scientific method is all about discerning collective intelligence. Our species as a whole is more collectively intelligent now than we were 50 years ago, or 500 years ago, or 5,000 years ago. Or 500,000 years ago. And public revelation is that. It's revelation. It's no less revelation than sacred texts are. But we're not used to thinking of science as revelatory. And part of that is because we often have had, since the last 400 or 500 years, many people in the West have had a trivial notion of God. So let me talk about what God is from this perspective and what God's not from this perspective. If I were to say what I think historically will be seen as the most significant public revelation, that is the most significant divine truth revealed through science, or discovered through science, I think it's this. The nested, emergent nature of God's creativity, or the nested, emergent nature of divine creativity. Now, first of all, what I mean divine, when I say the word divine, what I'm pointing to is the creator. That is that power, that force, that whatever that created everything. Whatever else we mean by God, when we use God language, we're pointing to the creator. All cultures have had at least that in common in terms of when they use God language. And what we now know, and I say know rather than believe, is that ultimate creativity didn't merely exist at the beginning of time and make everything the way a potter makes a pot or a carpenter makes a table. That divine creativity exists throughout the entire universe in a nested, emergent sense. When I say nested, you've seen nesting dolls, like Russian nesting dolls, right? Dolls within dolls. Subatomic particles within atoms, within molecules, within cells, within organisms, within planets, within galaxies. Goes all the way up and all the way down. At every nested level, divine creativity exists. That is, every nested level can create. The Apostle Paul couldn't have known this. Martin Luther couldn't have known this. This couldn't have been known or revealed prior to telescopes, microscopes, and computers. It took those before God could reveal these things. And when I mean God, what I'm meaning is a sacred proper, nothing less than a sacred proper name for that one and only ultimate creative reality that includes it all and yet transcends it all. In other words, to use the analogy of the nesting dolls, it's like the largest nesting doll, but then you'd have to imagine that largest nesting doll being infinite in all directions to try to get some sense of what I'm pointing to. But this is a God beyond belief or disbelief. This is a God, it doesn't matter whether you believe in reality or not. Reality is something that every plant, every animal, and every human being cannot not experience. In fact, you know what the Greeks, see, we are a subset of the whole. We can't get outside the whole to examine it, so we have to use analogies and metaphors to describe the nature of ultimacy, the nature of the whole, the nature of that creativity that brought it all into existence. And people living in different parts of the world would have reflected on different plants, different animals, different terrain, and different climate. So the analogies and the metaphors that we would use would be different because our words are based on our experience, right? And the stringing together of words into stories that explain where did we come from, why are we here, where's everything going, and why we're special as a people, and all cultures have these. There's not a single culture anywhere in the world that doesn't have a story or set of stories that explain these big questions. They're going to be different. And they're going to use a different blend of what are called day and night mind. So this is the other distinction that I want to offer. The first is between public and private revelation. The second is between day and night language. All humans have had a day experience and a night experience, and the two are not the same. We do things at night that we would never do or could never do during the day. We fly in our dreams, right? We fly. We converse with rocks and animals. We turn into other creatures. We walk through walls. We do all kinds of really interesting things at night in our dreams that if we did those same things during the day, we would call them miraculous or supernatural. But we don't call them miraculous, nor do we call them supernatural, because we distinguish our day and night experience. And yet, if we could do during the day what we do at night, that's what we'd be having, miraculous supernatural experiences. Now, if we judge our night experience by our day experience, then we call it bizarre. But it's not bizarre when you're in the middle of the dream. It's just your dream. And so all peoples have used a blend of day and night languages to describe these stories. Where do we come from? Why are we here? And so on. And our story in the West, or our stories in the West, also the same. You know that you're in the realm of night language when you've got talking animals, like a talking snake, right? A talking snake is something, an experience that all of us could have at night. But if you were to leave here tonight and go to your car and a snake would start talking to you, my hunch is the first thought in your mind probably would be, okay, who slipped me the LSD? Snakes don't typically talk to us during the day. It's not an experience we normally have during the day, right? In normal consciousness. So it's not a surprise that we find every culture using a blend of day and night language. This doesn't mean that this story is not true. It's just not true in a day language way if you judge it by day standards. And having this distinction between day and night language is really a vital one. Now, and I'll come back to this. I mentioned that the nested emergent nature of divine creativity. I haven't yet said anything about emergent. So let me say what I mean about that. When I talk about the nested nature of God's creativity or divine creativity, I think you get that with the nesting doll analogy. But when I talk about emergent creativity, what I mean is that we find ourselves in a universe. And again, this is virtually everything I'm going to share with you tonight is what 95, 97, maybe 98% of the scientists of the world agree with. I'm not going to be focusing on where there's really legitimate disagreement. I'm going to be talking about where there's broad scope agreement. And this understanding that all the complexity of the universe didn't happen at once. We see greater complexity emerging out of lesser complexity. To use Christian night language, to use night language using God language, God's up to something. There's a trajectory to evolution. Now, there's a way of talking about evolutionary directionality that's not accurate scientifically. I'm not talking about teleology in the way that it's traditionally known. That is the idea that there's some intelligent being outside the universe that's pulling strings or making it happen or has figured it all out. That's not the way I'm meaning. Okay? What I'm meaning is we find over, from the perspective of now, looking back 14 billion years, we find boatloads of evidence that the universe as a whole has gone from simple atoms. First, it was just the first atoms that were created were hydrogen, simplest atom. And then more complex atoms, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen. And then more complex atoms, and then molecules, and then more complex molecules, and creatures, and more complex creatures, and societies, and more complex societies. As one unfolding, emergent process that we grow out of, we emerge out of this process. We are literally the universe after some 14 billion years of unbroken evolution and complexity. That the universe, at least in this solar system, has become complex enough that the universe, creation, can begin to contemplate its own nature. We are literally the universe becoming aware of itself. We didn't come into the world, we grew out of it. In the same way that apples grow out of an apple tree. We're organically related to this whole process. We are nature uncovering its own nature. A human being looking through a telescope is literally the universe looking at itself and just going, whoa. A biology student looking through a microscope is the planet Earth learning with awareness, with consciousness, how it's functioning unconsciously in distinction from billions of years. As I said, we didn't come into the world, we grew out of it. And this understanding, I mean, I'll give you two quotes of my favorite, one of my favorite physicists, Brian Swim. Some of you, I don't know, are familiar with. Brian Swim says, he's got these two quotes. He says, 4 billion years ago, the Earth was molten rock, and now it sings opera. Earth was once molten rock, and now it sings opera. And nobody put anything here. When the Bible speaks of God forming us from the dust of the ground and breathing into us the breath of life, that's a true story. It's a tradition, sacred way. It's a night language way of describing the fact that we grow out of the dynamics of the planet itself. And it's a divine creative reality, the whole, in this case personified as God, that makes that possible. And how could Moses have said it any other way? So he wrote that. Here's another quote from Brian Swim. I think you'll like this one, but it's a little audacious. He tries to take the entire 14 billion year history of the universe and sum it up in two sentences. He says, you take a great cloud of hydrogen gas and you just leave it alone. And it becomes rose bushes, giraffes, and human beings. This is what 98% of the scientists of the world agree. This is not considered belief. This is considered factual knowledge. And this is religious knowledge. See, we're not used to thinking of the Hubble telescope. For 99% of human history, we thought that the heavens were perfection, immortal, the realm of the gods. Nothing ever changes up there. Here on Earth is where we found pain and suffering and decay, and these things needed to be explained. And yet now we know that if the meaning and significance of our religious traditions don't grow commensurate with the knowledge that we have from our various scientific, what's been revealed scientifically, we're doing our traditions a terrible disservice. I mean, this is death in the heavens. This is death in the heavens. These are stars that in their dying phase are creating carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen. And we don't believe that that's what they're doing. We know that that's what they're doing. We can measure how much carbon, how much nitrogen, and how much oxygen. This is the Helix Nebula. It's unofficially called the Eye of God at NASA. Does it look like an eye? I love it. But the folks at Nike say, this is the Eye of God, they've got proof God wears Nikes. It's actually two galaxies that are in a dance. But this is death in the heavens, as is this one here. This is the Cat's Eye Nebula. It's also a red giant star. It's creating carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen. In fact, to breathe, I'm going to take a deep breath. You just commune with red giant stars. I'm speaking something that's factually literal, day language. Because you just breathe in nitrogen and you breathe out nitrogen. You breathe in oxygen and you breathe out carbon dioxide. To breathe is to literally commune with red giant stars. Now this is birth in the heavens. In fact, Connie did a program about 3 years ago now where a little 8-year-old girl comes up to her. She's setting up for a church service. A little 8-year-old comes up and says, is this the Eagle Nebula? No, it is. Connie said, yeah, it is actually. And she said, see this section here? Baby stars are being born. It's true. This is a stellar nursery. Stars are coming into existence that never existed before. Birth and death exist in the heavens. And the Apostle Paul could not have possibly known this. John Calvin could not have possibly known this. This could not have been revealed then. This galaxy is 65 million light years away. That is, we're seeing it not as it is now, but as it was 65 million years ago. Because it's taken light, traveling 11 million miles a minute, 65 million years to reach our eyes. Does anybody know the name of this one? Yeah. Exactly. It's Andromeda Galaxy. Leave it to our youth to lead us, all right? It's Andromeda Galaxy. It's our closest neighbor galaxy. Until 1924, our best scientists all over the world thought that the entire universe was the Milky Way. And in 1924, Edwin Hubble, the Hubble Space Telescope was named after him, was able to discern this fuzzy little thing that they thought was in the Milky Way. Turned out it was its own galaxy 2 million light years away. That's what we're seeing this not as it is now, but as it was 2 million years ago. Because it's taken light, traveled 11 million miles a minute, 2 million years to reach our eyes. And this is our closest neighbor. In fact, if you didn't know that this was Andromeda Galaxy, you really should get to know our neighbors. Now, this bottom image is called the Hubble Deep Field photo. They took the Hubble Space Telescope and focused on a little itty-bitty patch of sky. None of the ground-based telescopes on Earth could see anything. It was completely black. In fact, if you took an 8-foot-long straw, okay, you know like you drink a milkshake out of, like a straw like that, that's 8 feet long, you look through it? That's how much little bit of sky the Hubble focused on, taking pictures for 10 days, sometimes keeping the lenses open for 40 minutes to capture photons from the deepest regions. And this is what showed up. Now this here, where my finger is, this is a star in the Milky Way galaxy. But every other dot, no matter how large, no matter how small, are all galaxies, like Andromeda. But some of these are 9 or 10 billion light years away. That is, we're seeing them not as they are now, but as they were 9 or 10 billion years ago, when the universe is quite young. The universe is said to be 13.73 billion years old. Now I say 2 million light years away. Some of these are 10 billion light years away. Somebody tell me, what's the difference between billions, billions, trillions, and zillions? Yeah, a bunch of zeros. We can't feel the difference between these numbers because they're so large, we can't conceptualize it. We can't get our heads and our guts around numbers like millions and billions. In fact, I don't even think zillions is a number. I'm going to offer a way for you to think about millions and billions, and I promise you, if you're like me, you will never think about millions and billions quite in the same way again. Check this out. A million seconds is 12 days. Okay, a million seconds, 12 days. A billion seconds is 31 years. You get that? The difference between 12 days and 31 years is the difference between a million and a billion. Trust me on this one, folks. Billionaires are not the same species as millionaires. And did you know that now as a nation we're $9 trillion in debt? Let's not go there, right? This is a super blue white star that has had a supernova explosion. In fact, this also is a red giant. But this one here, all the other atoms in the periodic table of elements are created when stars have a supernova explosion like this. My point being is simply that we have a different relationship to the night sky. Carl Sagan said it well at the end of his Cosmos series. He said, we are the local embodiment of a cosmos grown to self-awareness. We have begun to contemplate our origins, star stuff pondering the stars. We are literally stardust. Our bodies are made of stardust. Now, of course, that's an optimistic way of saying it. A pessimistic way of saying it is that we are actually made of the nuclear waste of dead stars. Same difference. Questions related to what I've covered to this point, I'm going to go to my PowerPoint here in a second. Okay, I'm going to go to my PowerPoint. Feel free. Periodically, I'll stop and say any questions, but you don't have to wait for me to do that. If I say something too fast or something's not clear, if you want to argue with me on something or whatever, feel free to, you know, just raise a finger, raise a hand. But yeah, if you could please cut down just the lights on that and leave the rest of the lights in the sanctuary up, that would be great. Connie and I have two websites, these websites right here. And about once every month to 3 months, we put out an email newsletter that just lets people know, because this is the Great Story website generates about 250,000 to 500,000 hits a month. So we're always trying to find new things that are happening in this evolutionary theology movement. And so once every month to 3 months, we put out an email to our list. I'm going to circulate a clipboard. If you want to get on this list, I promise you two things. One is you will never get more than one email a month. And you can easily get off the list any time. There should be enough light in here for... So we talked here about Andromeda Galaxy and the Hubble Deep Field photo. I want to share the first time that I ever thought about the distinction between private and public revelation. And also, really, actually, the day and night language. I was ordained as a United Church of Christ minister in 1999. I had been pastoring for 3 years. And I took the United Church of Christ, for my ordination paper, I took the United Church of Christ statement of faith. You know, we believe in God, blah, blah, blah. And I chunked it out in terms of this sacred evolutionary perspective. And those of you that are either athletes or artists, you know when you're just like at the top of your game, you're just like in the flow, you're just on? Well, it was one of those nights. I just felt like I was on. I delivered my paper, went well, I fielded the questions, the evening was going great. I started to get a little arrogant, a little big-headed, which is, of course, always dangerous. And there was a gentleman in the back. He raised his hand and he said, there's about 10 minutes left in the evening. He said, Michael, he said, I've been coming to these ordination hearings for 38 years. He said, and to be honest with you, I can't remember when I've come to one that I was more like, whoa. However, he said, and there's a certain way that he said, however, that I know is in trouble. He said, there's a little boy that lives in me, and my little boy wants to ask me the kind of questions little boys might want to know about religion. Like life after death, soul, consciousness, spirit. He said, in fact, what my little boy wants to ask you is, where is your mentor, Emory Wallace, now that he's died? See, I had been guided for 2.5 years through the ordination process by an 84-year-old retired minister that had studied with Thomas Berry and Brian Swim. He was totally into all this evolutionary theology. And he and I fell in love. I mean, I worked with him for 2.5 years. I totally loved this man. And he died 3 weeks before my ordination hearing. And everybody in this room, virtually everybody in this room, knew and loved Emory Wallace. And we were all grieving his death. And this guy stands up and says, the little boy in me wants to know, what's your evolutionary theology say about that? Where is he now? How would science describe that? Well, I had two thoughts immediately raced through my mind. One of them was, damn, this community went so well. The second one was, boy, this is your ordination hearing. You better speak. And I opened my mouth. I didn't even know what I was going to say. Call it trust in God, trust in the universe, trust in the unconscious. I didn't know what I was going to speak, but I knew I had to say something. I just opened my mouth and started speaking. And now I'm not trying to claim a miracle happened, but what I am claiming is I don't even remember thinking about Dan and Ryan before. But what I said is this. I said the only way to answer the question, where is Emory now that he's died, is to first use day language, you know, everyday discourse, what we normally talk to each other about in the daytime. And then night language, the language of our dreams, and poetry, and myth, and symbol. And the interesting thing is, and I don't know how many of you know this, if you keep a mammal from dreaming, we'll die. Did you know that? If you keep a human person or a dog or a wolf or a bear or an elephant from dreaming, we'll die. We don't even know why. And yet there's something about the dream state for mammals. We have to dream or we'll die. And yet we dream, as I said before, a whole different reality. We do things in our dreams that we would never do or could never do during the day. So I said, here, let me try to answer the question, where's Emory now that he's died? But let me first use day language, and then use night language. First, the day language, sir. Emory's body is being decomposed by bacteria. Ultimately, all that will be left is his teeth and his bones. His genes continue on his children, his grandchildren, his great-grandchildren. His impact, his influence, lives on those he's touched and influenced, those they've gone on to touch and influence, those they've touched and influenced. And so on. That's the day language side. But if I stop there, I haven't told you the truth. I've told you half the truth. In order to address the whole inner, non-measurable, yet nonetheless real aspect of human existence, I've got to use some kind of night language. Now, it doesn't have to be otherworldly. I suspect some of us in this room find non-otherworldly night language or metaphorical language more inspiring. But it traditionally has sounded otherworldly if you interpret it literally. So I said, here, let me try it. I said, Emory is at the right hand of God the Father, worshiping and giving glory to all the saints. Or I could say Emory is being held and nurtured by God the Mother. Or to use a Tibetan symbol system, I could say that Emory has entered the Bardo realm. In other words, there's no one right symbol system. There's no one right mythic or poetic or religious or inspiring way of speaking about the inner non-measurable aspect of human existence. But unless we use some kind of language, on this side, we're not going to address what most people need to find meaning for the simple reason that facts just sit there. Uninterpreted facts don't inspire, they just sit there. They have to be interpreted to be inspiring, and yet there's never only one right way to interpret any set of facts. Albert Einstein weighed in on this. Now, Joseph Campbell actually reported this in The Power of Men. He said, Einstein said that if you interpret the world's religious scriptures scientifically, what I'll call day language, he said he trivialized it. And the example he used was in the book of Acts. Now, I'm going to assume that probably most of us here are Christians, but for those of you that aren't, I'm going to just review what in the first chapter of the book of Acts, you've got Jesus in his resurrected form, okay, whatever exactly that means, is talking to his disciples, and they're saying, it's now time for the kingdom to come. And he says, it's not for you to know, these things are set by the Father. And you get the sense, like if ABC News or CNN or Fox TV were covering this for the nightly news, you get the sense that Jesus in his robes, just starts flying up, starts taking off, and just a few hundred miles up on the other side of the dome of the heavens, he's back with God. Because that was the worldview of that day. Space only went up a few hundred miles. Time only went back a few thousand years. If you were the author of the book of Acts and you wanted to communicate that Jesus returned to the source, he returned to the Father, the way Luke told that story was a completely legitimate, in fact, an excellent way to tell that story. But Einstein said, this is the universe we live in, this is the universe we live in. Actually, Einstein didn't have, well, he did have this picture, but he didn't have this picture. But what he said was, if you interpret the ascension of Jesus literally, like what I'm calling day language, he said, if Jesus flew at the speed of light, he not only wouldn't be outside the universe yet, he wouldn't be outside the Milky Way galaxy yet. And I just, about 4 months ago, I was with 125 evangelical ministers in the Bahamas, and I said to them, I said, yeah, I don't know about you, but seeing my Lord in orbit doesn't do anything for my spiritual sensibilities. The thought that I can look through a telescope and see the risen Christ up there is not inspiring me. So you got to realize we're talking night language. Doesn't mean it's not true. It just doesn't mean there's a different way of it being true. Have any of you seen this image yet? This is one of my favorite images of all time. This is an uncolored, touched-up photo of the Cassini mission. There's no color touch-up here at all. The sun is directly behind Saturn. This is a solar eclipse. This is a little piece of the sun right here. And that little dot right there, can you see that? It's one moon. Check it out right there. Can you see that? That's planet Earth. We don't believe this. We know this. Talk about a perspective shift. Here's a close-up from Mars. This is planet Earth. This is the moon. This picture was a telephoto picture taken from when our spaceships was out near Mars. Every transformation of humanity has rested upon deep stirrings of the intuition, whose rationalized expression amounts to a new vision of the cosmos and the nature of the human. Here's where it gets practical, folks. Okay, we've been talking a lot of cosmological stuff. This is where it gets practical, especially for those of us in the Judeo-Christian and Islamic traditions. I'm going to talk about how this perspective, how a sacred understanding of evolution realizes, that is, makes real what we thought were supernatural or otherworldly religious ideas. Talking about evolutionary psychology, evolutionary brain science, evolutionary ethics and morality, and human universals. See, there's a distinction between flat earth faith and evolutionary faith. Flat earth Christianity and evolutionary Christianity. Flat earth Islam and evolutionary Islam. And all religions right now are in the process of going from their flat earth understandings to their evolutionary understandings. Now, let me be clear. When I'm talking about flat earth faith, I don't mean people who believe the world is flat. It's where your religious doctrines, your religious concepts, your religious metaphors are still interpreted in the same way they were when people did believe the world was flat. So evolutionary Christianity would be where the core aspects of Christianity, such as original sin, salvation, the kingdom of God, heaven and hell, Jesus as the way, the truth, and the life, when these concepts are interpreted in the same way they were 500 or 600 years ago or 2,000 years ago, that's flat earth Christianity. When these concepts are reinterpreted in light of an evolutionary cosmology, that's evolutionary Christianity. See, I value those same concepts. Those same doctrines are precious to me. But I interpret them in a way that's universally true. That is true for everybody everywhere. Because it's about what we all know through our experience. It's not just what we believe. So what I want to talk about now is the realizing that is making real of the Jewish, Christian, and Islamic concept of the fall and the Christian concept of original sin. See, Jews and Muslims don't have a concept of original sin. It was invented by St. Augustine in the 4th century. But they point to the same thing. And all of them can be enlightened by this perspective. We now have an understanding through evolutionary brain science. As a result of functional MRIs, we can see the brain at work while it's working, while people are alive and conscious and thinking and fantasizing and fearing and, talking. We can see which parts of the brain are being used. And we have a very clear understanding now of what's called the quadroon brain. That is, we have very little evidence of an all-knowing, supreme intelligent designer outside the universe that designed the perfect human brain for human beings to thrive in the world. We have tremendous evidence that our brain evolved in an additive sort of way. We have the most ancient part of our brain, the reptilian brain, the old mammalian brain, the new mammalian brain, and the advanced brain. The reptilian brain is the brain stem and the cerebellum. This is the part of our brain that is all concerned with the issues of survival. In fact, you could say that, you know, when you fall, right? When you fall and you catch yourself and you think, wow, that was pretty good, right? You didn't have to think about it, right? It's the part of you that knows how to get hungry. You don't have to think about it. It's the part of you that knows how to breathe, how to get horny. Knows all the things that have to do with reproduction and survival are grounded in this part of the brain. Like, you could say that the reptilian brain only cares about the three S's: safety, sustenance, and sex. And prior to puberty, just pretty much safety and sustenance. Or you could say that this part of the brain can only really do five things, the five F's: fight, flight, freeze, food, and copulate. Come on, go to church. The old mammalian brain, the limbic system, the hippocampus, the amygdala, the hypothalamus, this is the part of our brain that comes into being with mammals. It's the part of our brain that's all about nurturing, care, bonding, kinship, reciprocity. If I'm nice to you, you're naturally going to want to be nice to me. If I'm nasty to you, you're naturally going to want to be nasty to me. Also, status is very important to mammals. The new mammalian brain, the neocortex, only two new drives come into being with the neocortex: the drive to comprehend and the drive to predict. Now, comprehend and predict for one. Why would evolution produce an organ that's really good at comprehending and predicting? Well, so that these drives can get what they want more effectively. It's why we are masters of self-deception. We are gifted at rationalizing. In fact, I've heard it likened that these two parts of the brain are like an elephant. And this part of the brain is like a little human rider on top of the elephant with reins, right? Now imagine, can you picture in your mind a huge elephant with a human rider on the top with reins? The rider thinks it's in control. But the rider is only in fact in control if the elephant doesn't have strong desires of its own. Like, let's say the elephant wants to go in this direction, okay? Now, let me say this. What the rider will always do, what the neocortex has to do, what it can't not do, is it can't not interpret. It will always interpret it. It's always making meaning. In fact, even if you say something's meaningless, you're making it mean nothing. We are meaning-making animals. So let's say the elephant wants to go this direction because there's an elephant of the opposite sex in that direction, because there's food or water in that direction. The rider will always say something like this: we're going this way because... And the because may have nothing to do with why, in fact, the elephant's going that way. There have been so many scientific studies on this. This is, again, something that's universally accepted among people who understand brain science and psychology. And then finally, the prefrontal cortex, the frontal lobes, it's the executive center of the brain. It can override these if there's a strong enough commitment, a purpose. That's why it's all about God's will or a higher purpose or your vows, your marriage vows are all, you know, when you speak marriage vows, this is the part of the brain that lights up. It's also the last part of our brain to fully develop in humans. Parents know this. Insurance companies know this. It doesn't develop fully until the age of 23 to 25. Now, Connie, my wife, is always trying to find fun, playful ways for kids, teenagers, and young people to learn this stuff. So we've created some ways to help us do this. So our reptilian brain, we call our lizard legacy. Our fur little mammal, our monkey mind, and our higher purpose. So let me say a little bit about these. Again, our lizard legacy is what all mammals and all reptiles have in common. It's the part of our brain that's concerned with safety, sustenance, sex, survival. Okay, the fur little mammal is bonding, kinship, play, status, nurturing. But notice there's a shadow side and a light side. It's not all warm fuzzies. See, one of the one of the evil aspects that comes into being with this part of the brain is what's called in-group, out-group mentality. We love and cooperate and share with our people, but it's okay to demonize other people. And all cultures do this. It's not, here's an example that most of us are familiar with, because I suspect most of us are familiar with the Judeo-Christian origin stories. But the Ten Commandments, right, in the Jewish scriptures, the Hebrew scriptures, the Ten Commandments, the sixth commandment, thou shalt not kill. Who did that apply to? Other Hebrews! It was okay to wipe out the Philistines! 20 million Canaanites destroy them all, thus saith the Lord. Now, I'm not picking on the Jews. I'm not picking on the Hebrews. You've got to hear this. All cultures have sacred stories to tell us why we're supposed to cooperate and why we're supposed to demonize them. But we got stories doing the same thing. Evolution theology offers a way of thinking that allows us to cooperate across our differences rather than kill each other over them. But that's what's going on in this part of the brain also. So it's not just all warm fuzzies. Now, the monkey mind is a term that comes out of Buddhism. It's the monkey goes from branch to branch, eats a little fruit, right? It's kind of our thoughts. We're always trying to figure it out. We're thinking about the past. We're about the future. We're anywhere other than right here, right now. It's why our meditation practices and our mindfulness practices are designed to help us be in the present moment rather than be obsessing with our thoughts, wherever those thoughts may take us. And then our higher purpose is, of course, our higher purpose. It's the part of our brain that deals with a commitment, project goals. It's the part of our brain that aligns with God's will, that sort of thing. Now, let me say something about how this realizes original sin and how this realizes the fall. Because these traditional night language concepts are pointing to something that's fundamentally true for all human beings, which is that we all have an unchosen nature. We all have inherited proclivities. We have instincts. We have aspects of ourselves that we didn't choose. We just find ourselves this way because our instincts evolved in a very different world in which we live in. For example, who of us chooses to be attracted to foods that have sugars, salts, and fats? None of us. We don't have to choose it. We just find ourselves attracted to foods that have sugar, salts, and fats. Why? Because for 99% of human history, it wasn't easy to find sugar, salts, and fats. So having a craving for these things allowed our ancestors to survive long enough to reproduce. Yet today, it's very easy to find sugar, salts, and fats. Yet we still have these cravings. Every single one of us, there's not a single person in this world that's alive today that would be alive today if some of your ancestors and my ancestors, all of us in this room are alive because our ancestors, some of them down the road, were really, really good at storing on to and holding on to fat through the lean times, through the droughts, through the harsh winters. In fact, those humans that couldn't hold on to fat got lost to the gene pool. They didn't pass on any descendants. And yet, they passed on their genes to us. Wasn't that generous of them? It's our unchosen nature.